It's the NACOcast coming to you from Canada's National Arts Centre in Ottawa. My name is Christopher Millard.
On the page, it looked nothing. The beginning simple, almost comic. Just a pulse, bassoons, basset horns, like a rusty squeeze box. And then, suddenly, high above it, an oboe. A single note hanging there, unwavering. Until a clarinet took it over. Sweetened it into a phrase of such delight. This was no composition by a performing monkey. This was a music I'd never heard. Filled with such longing, such unfulfillable longing. It seemed to me that I was hearing a voice of God.
One of the iconic scenes of modern cinema, with actor Murray Abraham as composer Antonio Salieri. This performance of a man turned bitter by envy resurrected our modern awareness of Salieri. Until Peter Schaeffer's 1979 play, Salieri had become largely forgotten, remembered for his relationship to Mozart and even his role in Mozart's death. Poor Salieri. He was born in 1750 and he lived until 1825. And during most of this long life, he was a hugely respected and successful composer. But history has not treated him so well. Did Salieri poison Mozart? This tale of a devoted musician whose reputation paled in the shadow of a younger genius makes for great theater, but is the story actually true? My guest on this edition of the NACOcast has devoted much of his attention to Antonio Salieri in recent years. Ian Kyre is one of Canada's foremost lawyers, an expert in information technology law, and a former partner at one of the country's foremost firms, Fasken Martineau. But Ian Kyre also holds a PhD in medieval history, and his inquiring mind has been drawn to the subject of Antonio Salieri. Not satisfied with researching and explaining the truth about Mozart, Salieri, and Vienna of the 18th century, Ian has completed a novel about Salieri. Well, I've been dipping into the manuscript, and it promises to be a wonderful read. Amadeus has left a compelling image of Salieri in our collective consciousness, but as Ian shows, it's largely fictional. Since the beginning of the 19th century, Antonio Salieri's reputation has been treated harshly and unfairly. So, I invited Ian to join us and tell the real story of this much maligned man. Ian Kyre, welcome to the NACOcast studio.
Thank you.
Well, it's great to have you here. I'm absolutely amazed that I'm sitting in front of an extremely well-respected lawyer in the field of intellectual property who also happens to have a PhD in medieval studies and who somehow has become absolutely and utterly fascinated with Antonio Salieri. So what's the story? How did this great passion come to you?
Well, it's a multifaceted story in a sense. I very much enjoyed the movie Amadeus when it came out in the 1980s. But to be honest, I didn't spend a lot of time thinking about either Salieri or Mozart at the time. I was too busy being a lawyer and spending many, many hours, far too many hours in the law office. But then I was in a music store about 5-6 years ago. I saw that they had brought out a new version of the Amadeus movie, the director's cut, which had a lot of background material about how they had filmed it and why they had done it the way they did and so on. So I became much more interested in that. Then I was in a used bookstore, and I saw a book called Salieri, Rival of Mozart, which had been published in 1985 when the movie came out, edited by Theodore Albrecht, a professor in the United States in musicology. But it was actually a series of articles that had been written in the 1860s by Beethoven's biographer, Thayer. He had come to discover Salieri through his studies of Beethoven, because Beethoven was a student of Salieri. And he thought that all of these rumors circulating about this terrible man, Salieri, and how he had ruined Mozart's life, and maybe even murdered him, that they weren't true. And so he wrote these articles. He, however, was both a terrible writer. They're wonderful in the sense of full of facts, but they are just not well written. And he had the disadvantage of publishing them in Dwight's Music Journal in Boston, which apparently nobody read
because they never
got cited by anyone. So they just sat quietly there for 100 years until this professor in the States came across them, was teaching a course on classical music, and he thought, what better way of sort of bringing the Mozart-Salieri rivalry to life than to republish these materials. So he did. I read them over and thought, this is a great story.
It is a great story, isn't it? It's part of our modern culture, those of us who are interested in classical music, to think badly of poor old Salieri. It's just in our heads, right?
Yeah, absolutely. It is. It's so funny because when you go back and you look at the literature on Salieri, he died in 1825, age 75. Already the rumors were circulating at that time about the fact that he had supposedly murdered Mozart. Shortly thereafter, 1830 is when Pushkin wrote Mozart and Salieri, the one-act play, which cast Salieri as this jealous person who was, recognized the genius of Mozart and himself being a second-rate composer.
It's essentially a study in envy in a relationship.
Absolutely in envy. And it's a story that we could all relate to. Regrettably not true, but that didn't matter. It was widely accepted, completely accepted, to the point where Salieri was seen as an inherently evil person.
Let me just stop you for a second.
Sure.
1825 he dies. Beethoven dies the next year. But according to our modern myth about Salieri, as portrayed in the film, already by the 1820s, he was apparently forgotten. But this is not the case.
No, it wasn't the case. In fact, one of my favorite lines, in a sense, in the Amadeus movie, is towards the end, where Salieri, he's now told the story, and the priest, that he's been telling this story to, is in tears. Mozart has died, and he's saying, God, your God wouldn't even let me share in one moment of his glory, because he was trying to finish the Requiem in the movie. They were doing it together. Salieri was writing down the music. Mozart was dictating it. And then he died before it was finished. But then he says, then for 32 years I have lived in torture as I've seen my music die and his rise to prominence. That's just, totally false. It's false in both respects, because Mozart was not nearly as popular then as he has become now, because the Romantic movement was there. They were casting Mozart as the beginning of the Romantic movement, but his music was not as highly regarded as Beethoven's or Rossini or other people, Weber, at the time. So they overplayed Mozart's position, but they underplayed Salieri, because during those 32 years of so-called torture, Salieri was one of the leading composers in Europe still. There was a decline in Vienna because of the rise of the Romantic movement and so on. Salieri's operas were no longer in vogue the way they had been in Vienna itself. They were still being performed elsewhere in Europe. Paris, for example, he had two leading French operas, Les Denys and Tarare, both of which were then, you know, still attracting large crowds in Paris.
Now, through the period from, say, 1800 to 1820, were Salieri's operas receiving the same amount of performances as Mozart operas?
I would say probably more, although it was starting to even out. I mean, during their lifetime together, and they only really interacted closely between 1781 and 1791, the last 10 years of Mozart's life. During that time, Salieri was much more popular as an opera composer than Mozart. And, well, Mozart had only done a few operas. Salieri had done by that time probably about 30.
But he was not a composer of orchestral or chamber music like Mozart was.
No. He did a few things early on in his career. He did a symphony, you know, a few concertos and so on. But really, no, he didn't write much.
And do you think this reflects who he was as a composer and who he was as a man, or was it simply a process of his engagement with the court?
I think it was a combination of the two. Because clearly he was a very pragmatic person. When you look at differences between Mozart and Salieri, I like to say to people, succeeded at life in a way that Mozart never did. He was a penniless orphan in Venice when he was found by Gassmann, who was then the court composer in Vienna, and brought as a young boy of 15 back and tutored and so on and turned into an opera composer, because Gassmann himself was an opera composer. And so his emphasis was always on that. But he was a big believer that dramatic music, that is, you know, opera, was really, that was the epitome of music writing in his view. And it was what he was paid to do. He was the director of the Italian opera for many years in Vienna. So part of it was, you know, that was where his emphasis was, because that's where his job was. But a part of it was also just his belief. Now, he was a student of Gluck and of Gassmann, and they were both primarily opera composers. So that's what he believed was the best. Ironically, it was that the teaching of Gluck that really brought him into conflict, to the extent there was a conflict with Mozart. It was a philosophical conflict, I think, as opposed to the way it's portrayed as a...
Political.
Political, yes. I mean, he had nothing to fear from Mozart. He was so much more popular at the time than Mozart was. And he was the director of the Italian opera. Mozart needed his permission to put his operas on. And he conducted... the orchestra for Mozart's operas.
And the evidence is that Salieri was supportive of Mozart.
That's right. Just as an example of that, Così fan tutti was was a commission that came initially to Salieri and then was picked up by Mozart. The same thing with La Commedia di Tito. That was something that Salieri was asked to do. He passed it on to Mozart. So those last years, you know, you see him providing some assistance to Mozart in terms of giving him materials to work with.
You talk about him as being a success at life. Give me a picture. What was he like? Okay. What was his family life? What was his personal life?
Okay, sure. That's a good question. I think when I say that he was successful at life, as I say, he was a penniless orphan who comes and he takes advantage of the opportunity that's given him and becomes a favorite of Joseph II. He was a very amiable person. When you read people, and a person who liked practical jokes, and he was Kelly, one of the singers of the day, wrote an autobiography back in the 1820s in which he said Salieri could make a joke out of anything. He was a very happy, charming person.
He's exactly also, opposite to what our picture is from exactly. that darn and, movie, huh?
Yeah, and a very helpful person. Like another example, in the 1820s, young Franz Liszt, he's just 9 years old, he's clearly got talent. And Salieri hears him playing. And his father is a servant of the Esterházys, needs support. Salieri got him, what I guess you'd say today would be a scholarship, from the emperor. And he never told the family that he was doing this. He didn't need to go out and seek, you know, additional accolades. He just did it because he thought it was the right thing to do. Later on, in 1823, this is the way the movie begins, with Salieri attempting suicide. That really did happen. And when the news of that came to the Liszt family, which was then in Paris, Franz Liszt's father wrote back this touching letter in which he said, oh, this is terrible. Just tell me this isn't true. You know, Salieri was one of the most helpful people, you know, the best teacher that I could have ever had. So you could really feel the, you know, the personal warmth. He was married for many years. Married in 1774, his wife died in 1808, I think it was. Teresa, she was a student of his, a music student, so they had seven children. Regrettably, only two of whom survived Salieri. His son, who he was teaching to be a pianist, unfortunately died at age 23. So unfortunately, he lost a lot of his children, but he was, from all the reports we have, a good father, a kind, gentle man, a helpful person. He organized the pension society for the widows and orphans of musicians. That's turned against him, in a sense, by the Mozart people who point out and said, well, but Mozart applied, you know, to that pension society and was rejected. That's because he didn't pay the fees. You know, you can't, unfortunately, join the pension fund and not pay what's required.
And above all, perhaps he was a gifted teacher.
He was a very gifted teacher. There are many, many of his students that we know very well.
Okay, so let's list them.
Okay. Well, we'll start with Beethoven, who was a student of his off and on for about 10 years. A frustrating student, Salieri is said to have shared with some people because he never did what he was asked to do.
I would imagine he had a mind of his own.
Indeed. In fact, there's a wonderful story told where remember, he's teaching him how to write opera and so on, and so Beethoven is working on Fidelio, and he gives it to his former teacher and asks for comments. And apparently Salieri went through it and made many, many suggestions, not one of which was implemented by Beethoven. And Salieri is reported as saying that, you know, isn't this typical of Beethoven? He asks for help, and then he doesn't even follow anybody.
But what did Beethoven get from Salieri?
Well, he...
what were the disciplines that were needed?
He taught him how to put words to music. That was, you know, and there are many of the studies that Beethoven did that are still preserved. And we have songs that he wrote and so on. Many of them in Italian. But he also, as I said, you know, used Les Denis, the French opera, to teach him how to put non-Italian words to music. He didn't himself write in German. One of the criticisms of him by the Germans, like Karl Marie von Weber, who was an anti-Salieri person, who really believed that Salieri had murdered his distant relative, Mozart, was that Salieri lived 60 years of his life in Vienna and never learned German. But that's because he didn't need to. French was the language of the court, and he was a court official. Italian was the language of opera.
Thank you.
Well, can you picture then what kind of advice he would be giving to Beethoven about writing in German?
Yeah. Well, what he did, he was quite open in saying that, you know, I can't teach you how to write in German, but I can teach you how I adapted these lessons I learned about Italian opera for French. And so he used this opera that he had written in Paris in 1783, Les Denies, as the method. And Beethoven studied that that opera thoroughly. When he died, found among his possessions was a copy of the score of Les Denies, this French opera by Salieri, much marked up. And in fact, there were a series of notebooks as well where Beethoven went through and studied various aspects of this and really did put a lot of effort into understanding how Salieri had put that opera together. And then this Theodore Albrecht, the same fellow who published the Salieri Arrival of Mozart, the Thayer articles, has done a study of these notebooks and discovered that Beethoven took one of the themes from the overture of Les Denies and turned it into a theme in his rondo movement of the first piano concerto, which was performed in 1790s. It could have been. There's some question about the 1795 performance. The very first public performance that Beethoven gave in Vienna was in 1795 at a benefit concert that Salieri organized for the pension fund. Beethoven complained the fact that he didn't get paid anything for this. They gave him a lifetime membership in the fund, but he needed money. But he might very well have performed the first piano concerto. It was either that or the second. There's some debate about which one. But he wrote in the first piano concerto. He included this rondo movement, and it may very well have been Salieri that conducted the orchestra for that, which
and Beethoven took something from Les Denies.
Les Denies, yes, and used it as one of the themes in the rondo movement.
Interesting.
He also dedicated a series of works. They were trios, I believe, that he did around that time to Salieri, who, by the way, he called the Pope of Music, because Salieri was such an important figure in the music community. In Vienna.
Well, did that have a double entendre?
It did indeed, and he meant it to have a double entendre,
right,
as well. Because, I'll give you an example. 1808, they had a scheduling problem. Beethoven was trying to raise money, and he had a number of works that he had done that he wanted to public perform, and he always had a subscription series and was selling tickets. He chose, however, the dates that Salieri traditionally chose for his benefit concerts. I think intentionally, because he knew that people were expecting to go to a concert, but he wanted them to pay him instead of going to Salieri's benefit concert. Of course, Salieri, who thought of these as his dates, was really, really upset. And he, in fact, wrote a letter to all of the musicians in Vienna saying, "You will not play at Beethoven's concert if you ever expect to play again." In Vienna. Beethoven, of course, was really, really upset with this and took this as an example that his teacher had turned on him, but later apologized. There's a touching tale told by another Salieri student, Ignaz Moscheles, who was a noted pianist. He was just starting to work with Salieri, and he went to Salieri's home, and as it happened, Salieri was out, and he saw the little card left by Beethoven on the table saying, "Your student Beethoven came to apologize." And he thought, wow, you know, if Beethoven can think that he can learn something from Salieri, then certainly I can. So they had a difficult relation to some extent, but they seem to have patched it over. They, for example, were both promoters of the metronome, which had just come out at the time, and they wrote an open letter in a music journal of the day from the two of them promoting it. So teacher and student, or you could say the dominant composer of the day and a former dominant composer, both promoting this.
Okay, so clearly he had a big influence on Beethoven. Who else was among his students?
Okay, Schubert was probably the person he had the biggest influence on because he started youngest. When Beethoven came to him, he was not only teaching only, voice or composing for voice, But Beethoven was already in his 20s, so he had formed a lot of his habits already. He got Schubert at age 9. Schubert had applied, or his family had applied, for him to go to a choir school and to sing in what we today call the Vienna Boys Choir. And Salieri himself did the auditions, and so he heard this.
Did Salieri conduct the choir?
Yes, he conducted the choir for the longest period of any conductor in its history. When the Vienna Boys Choir celebrated their 500th anniversary recently, they put out a celebratory CD which has on it as one of the first cuts a Te Deum that Salieri wrote for the Boys Choir in the 1790s, the Coronation Te Deum. It's magnificent work. That's the other thing that Salieri was doing, was writing not only operas, but he was writing for choruses and choirs and so on. Did a lot of church music, a lot of masses and so on.
So he took Schubert as a child.
He took Schubert as a child, and they all of these children had some instruction, but Salieri recognized early on that Schubert was special, and so he took him on as a separate private student in addition to the other instructions, and trained him then for the next almost 10 years. In 1818, when Salieri was celebrating his 50th anniversary in Vienna, it was like a national holiday. It was a big event. And they gathered all of his students together and so on, and they asked them all to write music. And Schubert wrote this absolutely wonderful, touching little piece in which he referred to Salieri as the universal grandfather and said, you know, you are the inspiration of my life and all of this. It's really, in a sense, juvenile in terms of music because he was just a young man. But you can just feel the warmth that he felt towards this man as his teacher.
Bleiben noch recht lange da, unser aller Großpapa, bleibe 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 noch recht lange da, unser aller Großpapa. Bleibe noch recht lange da.
So he had a tremendous influence on him. When he did his first Mass, Schubert did his first Mass, Salieri was in the audience. And at the end of it, he is supposed to have said, someday people will remember me as your teacher rather than you as my student. And of course, that's...
Very gracious.
Yes, Now, we don't remember Salieri at all.
But interesting is that you talked about how influential he was as a teacher of the synthesis of music and voice, of music mm-hmm. and text, I
yes,
suppose.
Yes.
And Schubert, of course. Right. What could be more organic and instinctive?
Yeah.
And mm-hmm. your suggestion is that the techniques and the disciplines that he learned from Salieri may be at the root of that ability.
Oh, I think so. Salieri was a very good teacher. He was highly regarded. A number of his students wrote memoirs about them, and they commented on the fact that, you know, the care with which he went through the compositions and so on. The other thing they all comment on is the fact that he did not try to impose his style on them. He let them have, you know, choose their own style, find their own voice in a sense, but he went through the technical aspects of it. We have another student who wrote about him later on was Franz Liszt. Franz Liszt was also 9 or 10 when he was a student of Salieri. Now, in this case, Salieri was a much older man. He would have been 73, I guess, when he was teaching Liszt. And he, by the way, taught his students for free. It's one of the things that Beethoven liked best about Salieri is that he didn't have to pay him. It's one of the frustrations that Mozart had when, how do you compete with somebody who's giving away lessons for free when he's trying to charge people? But Salieri didn't need the income because he had he married into nobility, which was wise, and he got all of his royalties from Paris because his operas there were very successful. He died one of the wealthiest men in Vienna, and certainly probably the wealthiest composer in Vienna. So he had money. He didn't need that, and he liked teaching, I think, and thought it was a way of helping the young people coming up. So, but the story I was going to say, though, is that young Franz Liszt gets help from Salieri. Then later on, this is now into the 1860s, 70s, when he's already very well established, he's approached by this fellow who is trying to put together a collection of the best operas done by the Paris Opera Company. And he's writing to various composers, trying to get them to sponsor or support this, you know, say, I think this is a good publication or whatever. And so Liszt is one of the people he writes to, and Liszt writes back to him and says, I'm not particularly interested in old operas. He said, but in your collection, I notice you have two Salieri operas. I will buy copies of those, because he said that was, you know, Salieri was my teacher, and I owe him a great debt. He said, he didn't teach me how to compose. Nobody can really teach you how to compose. He said, but he taught me the techniques of music, the technical aspects of music. And he said he was, you know, his instruction was invaluable.
I want to just back up just a little bit and just to talk about Salieri's own childhood. Now, he was originally found as a 14 or 15-year-old orphan in Venice.
Yes.
And when he was brought to Vienna, Gassmann, his teacher, I understand, did not allow him to compose his own music for several years.
That's right.
And that he was very, very rigid about making sure that Salieri only worked with what we would call the compositional studies, mm-hmm. studies in thorough bass, in fugue, in counterpoint,
yes.
all the very traditional things that, after all, gives a composer fluency. So I'm presuming, in listening to you talk about the difficulties of Beethoven, perhaps the ease of working with Schubert and Liszt as children, that it was basically those technical facilities, the ability to organize tonalities and scales mm. And understanding modulations and understanding counterpoint and the structures of music up to the point that gave these essentially genius talents the ability to express themselves successfully.
Yeah.
And he somehow was able to nurture that with these
yes,
individuals.
Yes, somehow. I mean, we have a wonderful fan letter from Fernand Herald, the fellow noted for his ballet. He wrote this letter when he was reviving Les Denys in 1818. He wrote a letter to Salieri saying, all of the success that I have enjoyed in music, I owe to you. Your lessons are invaluable. I wish I'd spent longer time, you know, with you in Vienna. And we have a number of these people who all say that, you know, he really knew music. Now, not all of them liked his own music, you know what I mean? But they learned so much about the techniques of music from him.
Surely, as we look at this picture this incorrect picture that we have of Salieri as being incredibly envious of what was obviously a greater natural talent, mm-hmm. Is this essentially what we're dealing with? Is just that it's a luck of the draw? He didn't have the genes. His brain wasn't hardwired to capitalize on his intelligence, his great attitude, his compositional skills simply didn't lift off the page like some of these people. And one understands why he would have this just incredible frustration.
Well, usually when I go and talk to people about Salieri, people who are really well-versed in music, they all say, yeah, sure, Salieri was an important teacher. He was an important historical figure. He controlled, you know, access to the theaters and so on. We don't deny any of that.
But at the level of Leopold Mozart, maybe.
Yes, that's right. But mm-hmm. we say, you know, but he's a second-rate composer. That's the way they begin. And I say, well, look, I have no music training as such. I mean, I studied piano and violin, as we all do as youngsters, but I never was any good at it. I've enjoyed music for a long time, but I have no training in it. But Cecilia Bartoli, she knows music. She has she loves Salieri's music, and she put out the Salieri album, which is, I think, a great album of some of his arias. Diana Damrau, the German soprano, she came across Salieri by accident. She was a young woman in Germany. They were looking for somebody to sing the lead in a Salieri opera that was being revived, more for historical reasons than anything. It was Kublai Grand Khan de Tartary, which was an opera that Salieri wrote in the late period of his time with Mozart, 1788, thereabouts, but never performed during his lifetime because it was a parody of Catherine the Great's court in Russia, and just when they were going to perform it is when Joseph II entered into an alliance with Catherine the Great to fight the Turks, and he thought it was politically incorrect to make fun of her, in this opera. So it was never performed. But anyway, they decided, to bring it out in the 1990s in Württemberg in Germany. They looked for this person. It was a small opera. They ended up with an unknown, Diana Damrau, who turned out to be obviously a great voice. And she sang the lead. Then when Muti was reopening La Scala in 2004, he looked back at his history and said, when La Scala was originally opened in 1778, the first opera that was performed was the Salieri opera, Europa Reconosciuta. So he said, I'm going to revive that. And he got Diana Damrau to sing the lead. So she sang early in her career two leads in two Salieri operas. And she discovered to her surprise and great joy that Salieri wrote wonderful arias, especially, as she would say, for coloratura sopranos. And we talked about him teaching composers, but he also taught the singers. His two godchildren, the two daughters of Gassmann, his teacher, both became sopranos singing. One of them, Teresa Gassmann, became Rosenberg after marriage, specialized in singing the Queen of the Night aria for her things, taught by Salieri. It's so touching in a sense that, we think of them as being rivals, but here he is, his goddaughter, who he is teaching to sing, specializes in singing Mozart's coloratura arias. So he taught them as well. So Diana Damrau, as they say, became very interested, and she, in her first album, Aria de Bravura, has seven Salieri arias in there. So those are people that I think of know music, and they've come to like his music. Christophe Rousset is a person who, he's a great harpsichordist, but he also conducts a group called Les Talents Lyriques in France. He was looking for an opera to do in Lausanne for a summer opera festival. And a professor at the University of Georgia, Dorothy Link, was somebody he knew. And she said to him, if you're looking for something that is a little different but very, very good, you should do Salieri's La Grotta di Trofonio. And he said, Salieri, yeah. But then he listened to it and he fell in love with it. And he now calls it the perfect opera. It was done, by the way, right at the height of Salieri's talent, in my view. He did Les Danaïdes in Paris and La Grotta di Trofonio in Vienna within a year of each other. Right in the middle period, the 1784-85, right when he is supposedly competing with Mozart. And it's really Mozart at this point in time that's learning from Salieri. We have lots of evidence of that. But more than learning, in a sense, because he is also trying to make a name for himself. So if I just go off a little on tangent and talk about early Mozart opera in Vienna. He comes to Vienna in 1781. At that time, what was in the Italian opera had been closed down. Salieri had been spending the last 2.5 years in Italy doing things like the opening of La Scala in Milan. So he'd come back to Vienna, and the emperor said, I want you to do a German opera. And he didn't speak German or know much German, but you don't say no to the emperor. So he did one, but it was a clever one, Der Rock von Kerr. It is about an Italian who writes opera. He's a chimney sweep during the day. He writes opera at night. And he's Italian, but the only market is for German opera. So he is teaching himself how to write German opera. So it's, in a sense, it's a little autobiographical.
It's a self-referential opera.
Yes. And so he writes this, and he has in the opera Italian arias and he has German arias. He has at the time a student, Caterina Cavalieri, who comes up in the movie Amadeus in a sort of comic role, who was the love of his life, not in a sexual sense, but I mean, he had great, great feeling for her. She was one of his first successful singing students, and he favored her career, did everything he could to help promote her career. So he wrote, gave her the lead in his opera. She spoke German, so it was perfect, and he taught her how to do Italian arias, so she had both skills. And she had a very wide range. So he wrote this special aria for her. And he wanted to make it a showcase aria. So he made it 5 minutes long with a one-minute musical interlude or introduction. And it was very, very successful. When Mozart comes, this is what he hears in the theaters. And he's working on the Abduction from the Seraglio. He chooses Caterina Cavalieri to play Constanza in that, and he gives her a 10-minute aria, marked in Aller Alten, with a 2-minute introduction. And if you look, listen to the two together, you can see that he has taken Salieri's aria and improved it. And so it is clearly, to my mind, sort of a throwing down of the gauntlet. The young man comes in and says, look, I'm going to take your thing with your singer and make it even better. And he does. When you listen to the two, they're both great. I love the Salieri aria, but there's no doubt that the Mozart one is better. He does the same thing with the introduction to the overture to Der Raub von Kerr. He's working on is The Marriage of Figaro. If you listen to The Marriage of Figaro overture, you will see that it is the Rauch von Kerr overture improved. In places, note for note the same. It's striking. In fact, the commentators later on, I think there's an article in the 1870s or 80s, in which he comments and said, isn't this remarkable that, you know, The Marriage of Figaro is so much like the Rauch von Kerr? Again, I think it was the same thing. It was... And Salieri conducted this, so he clearly knows this is going on. But this is just a little bit of one-upsmanship, I think. This, you know, the young man trying to make a name for himself. Again, I'm going to take your overture for your piece, and I'm going to make it even better. And again, when you listen to the two together, there is no doubt which is the better of the two. But it is something that was sort of a variation on a theme, you'd say. Now, there's a modern little footnote to this. I've been looking everywhere I can to try to understand the way Salieri is portrayed. And one of the things I looked at was Opera for Dummies. I remember my scholarly friends all said, why would you read Opera for Dummies? But in fact, people who are learning opera do read it. And it has a little section on Mozart and Salieri. And it says, you know, Salieri was a better composer than he's held out to be. You know, he was adequate. But we don't play his music now because it wasn't original, as opposed to Mozart. Take, for example, The Marriage of Figaro overture. I couldn't believe it. I thought, of all the choices to make to emphasize Mozart's originality, you could have emphasized his technique, his, you know, so many other things, but originality, it was not original. It was very much a borrowed work. Again, people don't appreciate that. I learned about this because we're now starting more and more to get Salieri's music out. There's another fan of Salieri, a German conductor, Thomas Fay. And Thomas has fallen in love with Salieri's overtures. And so he's decided to put them all out on CD. And he put out Der Rauchfangkehrer. And the notes to this tell the story of how Mozart had borrowed this for The Marriage of Figaro. So we're starting to see a lot more interest in Salieri, and people are starting to listen to his music. I'll give you another sort of contemporary example of the fact that the music is better than we think it is when people actually take the time to listen to it. I've been a supporter of Opera Atelier in Toronto for a while, and so come to know Marshall Pankowski, the musical director there. And after one of the fundraisers, they had a program for the fundraisers where, because they were doing a Gluck opera, they had some excerpts from Gluck opera, and then they did some Schubert songs. And he said, you know, to my ear, I can hear some Gluck in Schubert. And so I walked up to him afterward and I said, you know, there's a link, a direct link between Gluck and Schubert. Gluck taught Salieri, Salieri taught Schubert. So I said, there could very well be some Gluck influence and Schubert passed through indirectly through Salieri. So I said, have you heard any Salieri? And he said, no, no, why would I bother listening to Salieri? And I said to him, just, you know, give him a hearing. So he said, okay, fine, you know, come over and see me someday. But you know, I would call and he'd always be busy or whatever. Then finally one day I called and he said, okay, I have some time. So I went over with La Grotta di Trofonio and Les Denis. And we never got to Les Denis because he listened to La Grotta di Trofonio and he said, I can't believe that this music is not played. This is superb music. This is great opera. I'm hoping, in fact, that Opera Atelier will do La Grotta di Trofonio.
Here's this poor guy who's in his grave for 160 years, and then for the modern audiences anyway, who probably weren't familiar with Pushkin and Rimsky-Korsakov, Salieri had fallen off the radar. Mm-hmm. I mean, when I went to music school, I suppose I might have heard the name. But suddenly in 1979, when Schaeffer's play Amadeus comes out, he's on the radar. But what's portrayed ain't the original guy, as you're clearly mm-hmm. saying. This was obviously of a gifted, kind, considerate, successful man who does not need to be remembered inaccurately. Mm-hmm. So I guess the question I have for you, would it have been better if that play and that movie never been produced for Salieri, or has it actually brought the opportunity for us to evaluate him?
Yeah, the irony is that the misportrayal of Salieri in the movie is the reason why we know so much about Salieri today. I agree with you. Salieri had just dropped completely off the radar screen. Now, it wasn't just, I think it was intentional. In the 19th century, because they believed that he was the murderer of Mozart, I think they suppressed Salieri music, Paris being the exception. His music was played in Paris longer than anywhere else. But as I say, you'll read biographies of Schubert that don't even mention Salieri. He was his primary teacher.
So who's responsible for this rumor? Where did it? What's the original source as far as you can tell?
Mozart. Mozart and his father
the letters where they diss Salieri.
Yeah, that's
but
right.
It doesn't go to the point of accusing him of bodily crime.
No, no, indeed. No, it's a slowly building virus in a sense. It starts, and you can actually trace the origins of the rumor to when the letters began to be known in the early 1800s. And so, for example, in 1803, Weber is already believing that Salieri is a bad person. Now, he's distantly
he's
related
into the family.
Into
yeah.
the family. Mm-hmm. So when you read the letters, there's not a great deal of detail in the letters about Salieri. I mean, they effectively say that Salieri was tricky and that he, you know, did everything he could to prevent Mozart's music from being played and so on. But it doesn't say anything about murder. Now, Mozart dies suddenly in 1791 in his 30s. And so that raises a bit of suspicion. And he did write a letter to Constanze not long before his death in which he said, I think I'm being poisoned. So that began this. There are two important steps. I mean, one, this is a time of growing German nationalism. And there were a lot of people like Weber, who was German and who tried to get German operas produced, who were having trouble because the opera directors were Italians and they believed that operas should be played in Italian. And so that the conflict between the Italians and the Germans, even though Salieri was not Italian in any really meaningful way, he learned all of his music in Germany, in Austria, but he'd lived in Austria 60 years, and Maria Theresa certainly characterized him, the Empress, as a German composer. And his works didn't get much play in Italy, other than a few that when he went down in the late 1770s down there, they didn't get a lot of play there. They were primarily played in the German world, ironically, in Italian. So the rising German nationalism, there was a sort of a resentment of the fact that here was another Italian who was a dominant person in music, and we have Mozart saying these things about him, which, of course, they believed, and the suggestion that perhaps, you know, he was poisoned, and it just began to all, you know, and there's no real historical
paranoia
foundation.
Paranoia and chauvinism, and it all started.
And it just sort of slowly builds. And
took
then
a life of its own.
And then Salieri, in the last years of his life, knew about this. He tries to commit suicide in 1823. That's one aspect of the Amadeus movie that is correct.
Now, what was the stress that caused that? I mean, was it related to these rumors or something
that's
separate?
That's my feeling. At the time, a number of people said, here is, you know, it's his guilt over having murdered Mozart. But I think it's much more likely. Here's a proud man who couldn't believe that people thought that he had murdered Mozart. Now, he was also in poor health, and he was... some people think that, you know, he was going through dementia. You know, he's an old man. Mm-hmm. So there could have been some aspects of that. But we have a deathbed statement taken by Ignace Moscheles. When he's in the hospital, Moscheles, who is touring, happens to be in Vienna. And so he goes to see his old teacher. And it's just a heart-rending account when he goes in and sees, you know, how poorly he's doing. And what does Salieri say to him? He says to him, Moscheles, tell the world I didn't kill Mozart. So it was obviously on his mind. And he, you know, he was trying to get the message out. He said, you know, here, tell them, on my deathbed, I'm telling you, I did not kill Mozart. Didn't prevent the rumors from continuing to spread. And Pushkin, you know, within 5 years is doing his play and the rumors just spread. In 1860s, Rossini meets Wagner in Paris. And interestingly, who do they talk about? They talk about Salieri, who they both know as the author of Les Denies, which is still being performed occasionally in Paris. No, neither one of them, I suspect, thought it was great opera. But they talked about it, and they talked about the rumor that Mozart had been murdered by Salieri, which Rossini did not take seriously, but Wagner did. And
Wagner probably was a little more adamant in his nationalism.
Indeed. In fact, he referred to Carl Maria von Weber as the most German of German composers. And so he was a strong believer in German nationalism. And I think he thought, well, those Italians, I could believe they'd do something like this, you know, to our German genius.
It's so sad, isn't it?
It is. It's a very sad story, which is why I set out to correct the record, because I just can't believe that this kind, gentle, happy, you know, helpful man is characterized.
Has suffered this terrible reputation. Yeah.
And in the course, I began as a historian looking at the story and only came to his music in a sense through the story. But I must tell you, I have come to really admire his music. Uh-huh. It's different than Mozart's. It's simpler in its orchestration. Now, that was intentional. Mm-hmm. He was a student of Gluck. Gluck believed in beautiful simplicity. Mm-hmm. Which is where the silly comment comes in about too many notes in the... And Salieri did believe. I mean, we have comments that his students made where they said generally he was very respectful of Mozart's music, but he did point out several places where Mozart over-orchestrated to the point where you couldn't hear the opera singers because there was too much orchestration. He writes at one point, talking about Gluck, his hero, and said that one of the things he liked about Gluck is that Gluck could establish a mood, you know, and emphasize the words with a single note. And I thought, this is perfect, you know, because you see the contrast in musical philosophy between the single note Gluck, in a sense, and the many, many note Mozart. And Salieri leaned towards this beautiful simplicity. Beautiful simplicity did not win out, you know, with Beethoven and Rossini. And
it's part of your life's journey here to try to correct this terrible misrepresentation.
That's right.
Well, we appreciate you coming in and talking about this so much, Ian. I can assure you that I'm going to go out and I'm going to listen to some Salieri. Maybe I can even find some bassoon music, huh?
You can indeed. He liked the bassoon. He liked the wind ensembles.
Oh, he was a man of good taste. We know that. I thank you so much for coming in and talking to us about Antonio Salieri, a misunderstood figure in music if ever there was one.
Thank you very much for having me.
Thank you. I trust you found Ian Kyer's enthusiasm for Antonio Salieri as persuasive as I did. We clearly need to re-examine this man, both as a composer and as an important figure of the late classical era. Thanks for listening to this edition of the NACOcast. I'd love to hear from you, so send your comments, questions, and suggestions to us at nacocast@gmail.com. For the multimedia team here at the National Arts Center, this is Christopher Millard. Ma si è detto qui tra noi, non mi premi il conservare. Penso soi di vendemmiare nella cassa militare. Fatto ciò di cielo poi, i miei dritti fate voi. Affarati a fermi odore.